McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that swipes right for science. I'm Michael Crosser, next to me is Chad Tilburg, and today's title is Dating a Radioisotope. Hello, Chadwick.
Good morning, Michael.
So, Chadwick, we received a request from avid listener AVB, who wanted to know, what is the difference between radioactive dating and carbon dating?
Yes.
And you pointed out that we actually have numerous fans who have asked similar questions about...
about dating things.
Yeah.
Like, how do we know how old stuff is?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we thought today we would answer some questions about that.
Let's talk about it. And I like this. This is kind of a cool topic because it sort of blends something that's going on at the physics level with something that's also interesting at the biological level.
Yeah. Normally, those of you who just listen to the show and don't see the live feed of us recording, don't realize that whoever's not talking is actually falling asleep during most of these things.
Like, yeah, Mike's like taking his hand, like making little wah, 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 wah sounds.
So today we can both, you know.
Yeah, wow. I think you've just sort of undercut the premise of the show.
All right. So in order to talk about radioactive dating and stuff, let's actually go all the way back and define what an element is.
Okay.
Because basically, if people have taken any amount of chemistry, you're probably familiar with this big periodic table.
Heard of it.
The periodic table is full of these elements, and the way they're distinguished between element to element is, at its heart, really how many protons are in the nucleus.
Right.
Right. So an atom is made up of a nucleus, which has protons and neutrons in them,
mm-hmm.
and it has as many electrons orbiting around it as there are protons in the nucleus. It turns out that the number of electrons, well, that's how all chemical reactions are taking place, is basically just swapping around this atom and this atom want to pair together, or do they want to switch with other atoms and pair up and do things like that.
And that's happening at the level of the electrons, sharing of electrons?
Yeah, and so they're all, okay. All chemistry is taking place basically at what's happening with the electrons being shared by different atoms.
Okay.
But if you want to change which atom you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you have to go into the nucleus and change the number of protons inside the nucleus there.
Right, because it's the number of protons that determines which little letter we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Which designator,
so
hydrogen
for instance,
or helium or et cetera.
Yeah, so like hydrogen has one proton, helium
uh-huh.
has two,
uh-huh.
carbon has six.
Yep, nitrogen,
seven.
Got it.
Oxygen,
eight.
Yes. Iron.
Ooh, is that 26?
It is 26.
Oh, yeah. Can I get up top? Boom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I always joke with people who run half Iron Man that it's really a silicon man.
That's good stuff. Okay, so that's an element, and presumably each different element has different sort of fundamental properties associated with it.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so things like, what, mass and...
Well, actually, mass can change a little bit.
Because that's determined by the sum of the neutrons and the protons.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
For the most part.
You can actually have a given element that has a different number of neutrons in the nucleus. But the number of neutrons doesn't usually affect how the chemical properties of an element behave.
It's elementness.
Yes. However, it does affect how stable that element is.
What do you mean by stable?
So you've heard like charges repel, opposite charges attract.
Yes.
And so I have this nucleus just full of a bunch of protons. They want to fly away from each other because they're repelling each other.
Because they want to do this.
Yes.
They have hopes and dreams, is
they
what
do.
You're saying.
Okay. All they want to do is just fly away and okay. go off on their own.
Okay.
But they can't because there are some stronger forces in play, forces called the strong force, that are trying to keep them together.
Okay.
But if you have just too many protons just clustered together, then the strong force is not enough to keep them together, and they break apart.
And, okay, so they kind of fracture, just...
But what neutrons do is they don't have an electrical charge, but they do have the stickiness to help keep things together.
Oh, so because they have mass, is the strong force associated with having a mass or something like that? Or
no, actually, that's the holy grail of high energy physics, is to combine the forces of gravity with all the other forces.
I just sort of like wandered right into that.
Yeah, don't go down that
okay.
rabbit hole.
Okay, whew.
So they have this property called a strong force that keeps the nucleus together.
Okay. And so is this why the higher up on the periodic table we go, the more we tend to find unstable elements? Because
yes.
the more protons and neutrons you have in there, the more chance there is for the repulsive force of those positive charges overcoming whatever the strong force is that's holding them together.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's also why if you look at the masses of elements, that they don't just go up as a straight line. They actually, for heavier elements, you have to have more neutrons than for lighter elements, basically, to keep it stable.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And so elements that have the same number of protons, so that they're the same element, but have different numbers of neutrons are called isotopes.
Got it.
Just in case I throw that out later on, I just want to define that, nail that down right now.
Okay.
So the real conversation we're going to have today are, how do we change the number of protons within a nucleus?
Mm-hmm.
And the two main ways that we do it, not including like fission or fusion or anything like that, but the two normal ways that things, it just naturally happens a lot in nature, are what are called alpha and beta decays.
Wait. So you just are like, well, we're just going to ignore fission and fusion and things like that. I mean, can we just real quickly define those and
So fission is ripping apart the nucleus in bigger chunks.
Okay.
Looking ahead, this alpha decay is actually taking away two protons and two neutrons, basically helium, spitting helium out.
So it's a tiny little fission.
Sort of, yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you can say that, yeah.
Okay. And then fusion?
And then fusion is when you're actually combining lighter things to make something heavier.
Okay.
So fusion and fission are the opposites of each other.
Okay. And so clearly those are going to change what element you're talking about.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're talking about today.
Yeah. If I have a hunk of uranium, it's possible for it to spontaneously to break apart and have fission happen to it.
Uh-huh.
But generally, you're going to hit it with a neutron to kind of break it apart to help it out or something like that.
Okay.
It's much more likely to undergo one of these other processes that I'm about to talk about.
So to get fission to happen, do you need to do something to it? Like you said, hit it with a neutron. And so if you hit uranium with like a beam of neutrons, that's going to break it into...
We have an episode somewhere in the archives.
Okay.
On Digital Commons.
Uh-huh.
About nuclear power. And we went into a lot of the details of that.
But okay.
Basically what happens is for power or for making a bomb or something like that, you have a neutron that breaks it apart, then the breaking apart of the uranium will create a lot of energy. It will also spit out like three neutrons, I believe. And then those three could each hit a nucleus and then that can trigger an event happening.
Okay. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is something that's happening spontaneously in the nucleus.
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason they're called alpha and beta is just because that's the order in which they were first found.
Okay.
They could have called it 1 and 2 or A and B.
Okay.
But they were fancier and they used the Greek letters of A and B as alpha and beta. So, where alpha decay is just when basically a helium atom just flies out of the nucleus.
Okay. And so that reduces the number of protons by 2.
Yes.
And the number of neutrons by 2.
Correct.
So wherever you are on the periodic table, you'd have to skip down two numbers.
Correct.
To figure out what you have.
Yes.
Okay. Alpha decay.
Yeah. And it creates these things called alpha particles, which are, so if you ever pick up a radioactive substance, if it's an alpha decay particle, it's letting out these alpha particles.
Uh-huh.
But it's helium atoms, so they're not going to go very far. They're kind of heavy, so they're not moving very fast. A piece of paper will actually stop most of them from moving. So
is alpha radioactivity not particularly dangerous? Is that kind of what you're saying?
You don't want to eat this stuff.
Oh, okay. So
it can still cause some bad stuff to happen. But, but yeah, it's not the worst thing in the world.
Okay.
Incidentally, by the way, this is one way you get helium gas.
Ah.
There are little pockets underground of helium gas that just from radioactive decay and stuff.
Oh, okay.
The second way you can have a decay is the beta decay. And so what happens in a beta decay is that basically you have a proton can turn into a neutron, or a neutron can turn into a proton. It can go either way sometimes.
And they're both called beta.
Yeah. One's beta plus, one's beta minus. But
okay. All right.
But the real take-home message here is that protons and neutrons are not like these completely independent things, that they can actually flip from one to another.
Huh.
And there's some more stuff happening in the background that I'm just trying to wave my hands around. But
okay.
You can turn a proton into a neutron.
And does one happen more often than the other? Like if we're talking beta decay, or we're normally talking proton turns into neutron? Or is it sort of like half and half? Is there a balance in the force?
Well, the balance would be to get to a stable nucleus.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes, you know, so beta decay, normally, I would say it would actually turn a proton into a neutron.
Okay.
So for instance, that happens in the sun. The sun will try to squeeze two protons together to make helium, but a helium with just two protons and no neutrons is not stable at all.
Mm.
But if one of those suddenly turns into a neutron, then you have something called deuterium.
Okay.
And that's a little more stable.
Okay. And so if you fuse two deuteriums, then do you have helium?
Yes. It doesn't actually do that, but that is...
The math works.
Yes.
But, okay. It doesn't actually happen that way. Okay.
We're getting into the weeds.
Sorry about that.
That.
Okay. So we've got this alpha particle generating process and this beta process.
And so specifically, let's actually bring this home. So we're ultimately going to be talking about carbon-14 dating.
Okay.
At some point today.
Yes.
So the number 14 is basically the mass of that atom. And so normally, a stable carbon atom is carbon-12.
Because it has six protons.
And six neutrons.
Six neutrons.
Yes.
Adding up to 12.
Yes.
Okay.
But the radioactive form of carbon, the radioactive isotope of carbon, is six protons, because it has to be. Because
it's carbon.
Yeah. And eight neutrons.
Okay.
And the way you get carbon-14 is actually nitrogen gas in the outer atmosphere will be hit with something from outer space. So nitrogen has seven protons and seven neutrons.
Uh-huh.
And what will happen is one of those nitrogen atoms, a proton will turn into a neutron,
okay,
which will turn it to six and eight.
Got it. So the way you get carbon-14 is from regular old nitrogen.
Yes.
Huh. Is nitrogen-14, that itself is not radioactive.
Correct.
What you're saying, it has to be hit with something to,
yes,
to energize that transformation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. Okay.
It'll stay as carbon-14 for a certain amount of time.
A period of time, yeah. Okay.
And then randomly, at some point, it'll turn back into nitrogen-14.
Okay. So...
So it will beta decay one way and then beta decay back to be the more stable nitrogen-14.
Huh. Okay. All right. So when we're talking about radioactive decay, mm-hmm, and its utility for dating things, then,
yes,
then we need to start thinking about not just a single atom, but a whole big bunch of atoms that... Like enough to form like a rock.
Correct.
Or something like that.
So I just said that a carbon-14 atom will stay that way for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But just randomly, at some point, one of those neutrons will turn back into a proton.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll turn back into nitrogen. But that's a random chance. It's like throwing dice, right? If you get snake eyes, then maybe something will happen.
Okay.
But if you don't, then you're, you know, this is like playing Sorry or something like that. You're like at the last... step on the board and you're just like, hey, I need to roll a three, and you know,
right,
you're just sitting there forever and then everybody catches up and you're annoyed. Yeah. So that's the same type of game here, is that the carbon-14 is just rolling the dice over and over again.
And so there's just a certain probability that you're finally going to get the right number.
Yeah. Eventually it will hit. Eventually it will say, oh, okay, now I can switch over and it will do that.
Yeah.
And it'll turn back into the stable form of nitrogen.
And if you had like thousands of people all playing Sorry at the same time, all of them needing a three,
yeah,
on every single roll, at least some proportion of them would get the thing they needed, right?
Yes.
Just probabilistically. So some fraction of them will, on each turn, make it over that hump.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, so I like this analogy, but let's make it simpler.
Okay.
So let's say we're playing a game where we're all flipping coins, and if we get a tail, then we're out.
Okay.
We lose. We're gone.
Okay.
And so only the people who keep flipping heads will stay in the game.
So let's say we start with 1,000 people. We all have a coin. We all flip it at the same time. We would expect...
So it's a probabilistic. So it's roughly half and half. And it won't be exactly. You know, we've got 1,000 people. We won't exactly have 500 get heads and 500 get tails.
But yeah.
It's going to be pretty close.
Roughly. Okay.
Yeah. So let's say, for this analogy, let's just say it does. So we've got, after the first flip, 500 people, they're out. They're done. They've turned back into whatever it was that they were supposed to be.
Okay.
And then we flip it again. And again, this time now another half will disappear.
Uh-huh.
And then flip it again and another half and another half and so forth.
So we've gone from like roughly 500 to roughly 250 to roughly 125. So if you were to plot this, this is not like a line.
No, because your first step is a big doozy.
Uh-huh.
And then it's kind of slowing down and slowing down.
Uh-huh.
Until, you know, the last players, out of 1,000 people, it'll take several turns before you finally get rid of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people just keep flipping heads over and over again. Rosencrantz, for instance. That's a weird reference.
It is, yeah.
But what we could do is we could say, oh, well, after the first turn, roughly half the people got it. So that's like, it takes one turn for half the people to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we instead change this and said, okay, how about we're rolling dice instead?
Hmm.
And if you get snake eyes, you got a 1 in 12 chance for that. And so from that, you could calculate how many rolls you'd have to do before basically half the people disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could call that the half-life of that.
Okay.
This is all talking about just probabilistic stuff here.
Okay.
And so that's also happening in the atom.
Okay.
That, you know, a radioactive atom, there's a certain amount of time where if we had a mass of, say, uranium.
Like 238 or something?
Of uranium-238, we could measure about how long it would take for half of those, just randomly, for half of those to go through some radioactive decay.
And to no longer be uranium. And so, presumably, depending on the element we're talking about, how long this takes to get to half remaining varies widely.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All the way from microseconds all the way up to, you know, basically an infinite amount of time.
Uh-huh.
So like helium, mm-hmm. two protons, two neutrons, is, we call that stable, but it technically has some half-life of some ridiculously high number.
Like many billions of years.
Yeah. And so basically, you'll sometimes hear people talk about the half-life. And the half-life is just saying, like, if I start out with 100 grams of this, once we pass this amount of time, half of that stuff is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And turned into something else.
Yeah.
And then if you wait another, that same amount of time, then half of what was left will be now turned into something else as well.
Okay.
But that actually gives us a good clue for dating stuff.
Yeah. And so because this happens sort of probabilistically and presumably it is unaffected by what? Its environmental conditions, like whether it's in space or in the ocean or whatever, it's just still ticking along, kicking out these particles.
Right.
With a certain probability.
Yes.
Okay. And so that seems like it would form the basis of a good clock.
Exactly. And so, like, if I had a rock and I could weigh the rock at some time and then later come back and weigh it again and I say, oh, half of it is gone, then I would be able to tell how much time passed. Well, and I don't know what a single atom is going to do because it's random.
Right.
But when I'm looking at billions and billions and billions of atoms, then it comes out pretty nicely.
Okay.
Just like with flipping a coin, if it, we were playing this game, the coin flip, and it was just the two of us, both of us may get heads the first time, and both of us may keep getting heads for a while. But when once you get to 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people, then it's going to be closer to half of the people will get heads and half of the people will get tails.
Mm-hmm. So do you mean to literally say that if we had this hunk of uranium-238, and after a certain amount of time, half of it would be, I'm using air quotes here, for gone. It's not technically gone, right? It's like maybe the alpha particles or whatever it is that U-238 is kicking out have maybe spiraled off into wherever.
Right.
But the rest of the atom is still there.
Correct.
So we're not technically thinking about, like, if we had 100 grams of U-238 after one complete half-life, it would be 50 grams.
Correct. It's more complicated than that.
It would be.
But for instance, if we're talking about something with carbon 14 in it, and then the carbon turns into nitrogen and isn't bonding, that nitrogen may just escape.
Okay, so it depends what it turns into. So, like, if it turns into like something gaseous,
right?
That gas could escape.
And so, for instance, uranium will eventually turn. One of its byproducts ultimately is radon gas, which particularly in the Midwest and stuff, like people's basements, they have to test for radon gas. Because if there's just a lot of uranium around, then radon gas will get into the house.
And,
but radon gas is also has its own half-life and will eventually turn into lead. And so the reason you don't want to be breathing a lot of radon gas is that eventually it will turn into lead and you don't want lead in your lungs. I pulled out this piece of paper with the overall life path of uranium. And we won't go through this, but uranium-238 will turn into something called thorium. The thorium will turn into protactinium. And then it'll go on and on and on, turn into radon eventually with a half-life of only about 4 days.
Oh, so that radon gas, that's why it's such a concern, because once it's in your lungs, after just a couple of days, it actually turns into something else.
Exactly. Yeah. So some of these things will happen pretty quickly. So
yeah. So if you're breathing in radon-222, after just a few days, it looks like that will have turned into lead-210.
Yeah.
Which has a much longer half-life, 22 years, which all things considered is actually pretty short if we're talking about radioactive isotopes. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like human lifespan, that's relevant.
Yeah. So you are correct that if I had a hunk of uranium 238, and I measured it sometime later, it would have a mixture. It would have some thorium, it would have radium, some other different elements just kind of mixed in there with it.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, it would also have a bunch of lead-206.
Yeah, lead-206 is a stable isotope.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, lead is something that, if you're dealing with radioactive material, sometimes you'll have lead bricks, because lead is not going to react with stuff, and it'll actually block a lot of radioactive particles. Yeah.
And so if we're wanting to date, say, a rock
mm-hmm.
on the surface of the Earth, for example, or maybe a meteorite that lands on the Earth, what would we consider to be the starting point?
So that can be tricky because you could imagine, like, if I had a meteor that was big enough to actually melt, then it's going to do something called differentiate.
Okay.
The heaviest stuff will kind of sink to the bottom, to the middle. We're talking about gravity, so the middle is the bottom.
Okay.
So the heavier stuff will tend to separate from the lighter stuff. And so then when this meteor comes into the Earth's atmosphere and breaks apart and so forth, we might get a hunk of some heavy material, such as uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Or we might get a hunk of some other material that did not burn up in the atmospheres.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that, then we could pick up a meteorite and look at it and test it and see what is left behind.
So what fraction of it is uranium and what fraction of it is lead or something?
Yeah.
If we're using that method?
Yep.
Okay. And by knowing the half-life of how long it takes to get from U-238 to lead-210, we can sort of, by knowing the ratio of U-238 to lead that's in our specimen, we can sort of use that half-life to sort of like skip back to how long ago it must have been formed?
Correct.
Is that right? So what about rocks on Earth? They're originally formed, I guess, by some sort of volcanic outpouring, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is that the moment, like when that lava cools?
Well, so here on Earth, you can look at the rocks and be like, okay, this is made up of these particular elements.
Okay.
And then you can use those and kind of compare, like, well, here's one layer of this rock. And if I dig down a little bit deeper, here's another layer of this rock. So we know that if we're talking about volcanic activity, you know, that a volcano will erupt multiple times and just add layer on top of layer. So we know if we're digging down, we're going back in time.
Mm-hmm.
But we can also just look at those rocks and kind of compare them and see what's left over. And similar approaches could be done with, you know, we've been to the moon and we've actually brought back rocks from the moon. And it's actually interesting. I don't know if you've noticed this. When you look at the moon, there's like sort of a darker splotchy part on the moon. The moon is mostly white color.
Yeah.
But there's sort of some darky splotches on there.
Yeah.
Those are actually from volcanoes as well.
Oh.
Just lava flow kind of covering it all over.
From a long, long time ago.
From a long, long time ago.
Uh-huh.
But we have been to the moon multiple times and collected rocks from the dark splotchy areas and from the non-dark splotchy areas. And we can tell that those are very different ages of rock.
Hmm. Which one's older?
The non-splotchy. The darker stuff is younger.
And so why is that? Where's the lighter colored stuff coming from?
The lighter colored stuff, it's actually kind of a fine powder.
Okay.
And so it just reflects light very well.
Okay.
But then the splotchy stuff was just lava that kind of covered over those layers.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, it doesn't reflect light as well.
Okay. All right. Should we talk about how this can be applied to understanding how old things are? Or there's other elements that we need to know about radioactive decay, half-lives?
No, I think that's the key. I mean, the basic principle is that we know every isotope, what the half-life is and what it will turn into, and all sorts of good stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with dating methods that are useful for things that are relatively young then.
Okay.
You mentioned carbon-14.
Mm-hmm.
So the stable isotopes of carbon are carbon-12 and carbon-13.
Mm-hmm.
And carbon-14 is the radioactive one.
Correct.
But it's just carbon, right? And so there's a certain amount of it that's in the atmosphere, part of carbon dioxide molecules that gets taken up by plants in photosynthesis, gets converted into biological molecules.
Right, because plants are basically eating the air, eating the carbon dioxide.
That's right. They build their bodies just out of thin air.
Yeah. Which is kind of...
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're not impressed by that, then you're not impressed by much.
Yeah.
My opinion.
But so there's a certain ratio of the carbon in the atmosphere, of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, in which that carbon is actually made up of carbon-14.
Okay.
It's being created all the time.
Mm-hmm. And so what we would expect is that something that is currently alive, right, like a plant or something that eats plants or something that eats plants, would have a carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio in their own physical makeup.
Yes.
That reflects atmospheric levels of carbon-14, right?
Exactly.
Because we're living things are sort of continuously taking in carbon and getting rid of carbon. And so because we're an active part of the carbon cycle, we reflect what the atmosphere is. And so when that thing dies...
Now all of a sudden you close the case.
Yeah. Case closed. Okay, I like that.
And all of a sudden now, you know, let's say you're buried. It's a sealed container with... It started out with the right amount of carbon-14 and carbon-12.
Mm-hmm.
But then over time, that carbon-14 is turning into nitrogen again.
Right.
So if you go back and you measure how much, what that ratio is of carbon-12 and carbon-14, now it's going to be different.
Yeah. And so the older it gets, the less and less carbon-14 is going to be there.
Correct.
And so the half-life of carbon-14 is something like 5,700 years or something like that?
No, you are exactly right.
Okay.
You actually know that.
Yeah.
I looked that up. I thought you cheated. But.
No. Okay. That's one I actually know.
Okay.
At least I thought I knew it. So that's why carbon-14 dating is useful for relatively recent things.
Yes.
Because it has such a short half-life. Short when you think of sort of like the entire history of planet Earth.
So 6,000 years is very long for recorded history, recorded human history.
Okay. All right.
But yes.
Yeah. So it's useful for things that were once biological in nature and that are in the thousands to tens of thousands of years old.
Yeah.
So that's useful for recent cultural artifacts. And
yeah. So, for instance, it was believed this something called the Shroud of Turin should have been 2,000 years old. And they were able to date this and be like, oh, well, that's not actually that old. It's much, much younger than that.
Wasn't it like Renaissance era or maybe a little older than that or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or dating things like pottery shards.
Yeah.
Or, you know, little fragments of food material stuck to a pottery shard.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that, dating skeletal remains that are young enough that they haven't fossilized, but are old enough that... So then if we're going to get to older things, then we need other methods.
Yeah, then you need something that has a longer half-life, if you can find it.
Yeah.
But on the flip side there, since the half-life is about 6,000 years, you're not going to get down to like, oh, well, this person died in 1981 on April 5th.
On a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah. With any of these, there's like a certain percentage of error.
Yeah.
Right. So for things that are starting to get into the millions of years, there's also potassium to argon is another series that I've heard of being used.
Okay.
And that's like radioisotope, I think, is 40, K40.
Okay.
And then it decays to argon, which is a gas, right?
Which is a gas, yeah.
Okay. And so that has a half-life of like 1.3 billion years. So that's useful for things that are like 100,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're getting kind of in the range of really early modern humans and then older. And so the dating of the Australopithecus afarensis fossil that everybody knows as Lucy.
Oh, I was going to make fun of you for a while. I was like, yeah, no, we all know the
Australopithecus afarensis.
But okay, yes, yeah, I do know Lucy.
You've heard of Lucy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she was dated by using this potassium argon method.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because potassium is something that we incorporate in our bodies.
That's true. But the way that these older fossils are dated is actually typically not by dating the materials of the fossils themselves, but by actually finding geological deposits above and below where the fossils were found and then bracketing in the volcanic deposits, right? And so vulcanism like lays down a layer and then there's, several million years of sedimentary material building up. And the fossils in those sedimentary materials. And then there's another instance of vulcanism that puts another layer of volcanic rock above that sedimentary rock, right? And then there's more sedimentary rock that forms on top of that. And so as you're going down through these layers, we know how old those volcanic layers are.
Right?
The layer above it, that volcanic rock dates to 130 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this layer of sedimentary rock where a bunch of fossils are found. And then beneath that is a volcanic layer that dates to like 155 million years. So you know that this window of sedimentary rock dates to between 135 to 155 million years ago.
Very cool.
Yeah, so it's sort of inferred by what we know of the surrounding. So, yeah, forms a good clock.
Yeah, cool. So we haven't actually formally answered what AVB's question was, the difference between radioactive dating and carbon dating.
I would say carbon dating is a subset of radioactive dating.
Yeah, so carbon dating is radioactive dating, but radioactive dating is more broad than just using carbon.
So there's uranium to lead, potassium to argon, and a few others that are like carbon dating.
Yeah.
Right? In that they're all forms of radioactive dating. And I guess it's just a matter of what kind of specimen you're working with as to which tool you should use, right? So like it would be inappropriate to try to use uranium lead dating to date something that's only a few thousand years old.
Yeah.
Because the half-life of uranium to lead is so much longer that you'd get this huge error in your measurement, right?
Sure.
It'd be sort of like using a yardstick to measure something under a microscope.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Wrong tool for the job.
Yeah.
So.
Excellent. Anyway. By the way, if you have a question that you would love for us to answer, we would love to answer it. You should email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com. All one word, all lowercase. This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rody Ortega wrote our theme music. Like us on Facebook to see what we're up to and other awesome content that we happen to find and repost. Tell your friends about us. If a friend of yours asks on Facebook what podcasts are good to listen to, you should tell them about Crisscrossing Science. If you like this podcast, subscribe to it and you will download the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, you should leave a comment and a rating, and that will also help people find our podcast in the future. Until next time, thanks for listening.